everybody there, especially since Julian Bond died recently.
He was absolutely one of my favorite people.
Me too. I was so hoping he was going to be at this.
Yes.
I was.
Now, his brother-in-law worked in Crawfordville, Howard Moore. And he's a Facebook friend.
I was in the... Hey, there he is. Just checking. Three. Number three.
Okay. I don't know from numbers. I know restaurant, Dunwoody.
I'll sit down if you want.
Yeah. I'll come back in a few minutes after I make sure everybody has a recording.
Oh,
okay.
When Bond was elected to the Georgia legislature, I happened to be in Georgia at the time. I went with another person to sit in the gallery and watch.
Oh, wow.
And they all stood up, and he had to sit while everybody else took the oath.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, was this when he was couldn't be accepted because of the Vietnam, his war?
Well, I understood the issue was that he was, there was some kind of, he'd made a statement and,
mm-hmm.
You know, I can't really remember that.
It was like
he was excluded from the legislature.
Uh-huh, right.
I think it took, a couple of years before he could
go back. He had to file a suit.
Yeah, and they finally let him in.
So what was the issue?
Opposition to the war.
I think that's what it was.
Yes, he had made statements opposing the Vietnam War, and then somehow, I don't know how they legally could get an elected person out of the legislature, but they did.
They did,
Well, they could just say, and what else can you do?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Until somebody...
And other black people were elected that year, and they were sworn in.
So the incident you're describing, people were being sworn in, but he was not.
Right.
There's a photo of it that
yes, there's a great
James
photo.
Bond has circulated since.
It's a great photo of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Him sitting down and the rest of it.
Yeah, sitting and all the others.
Well, I haven't seen that.
But he was the only black person had been elected, right?
No, there were two or three others.
There were.
In that same?
And they were sworn in.
It was
murky about it being done on racial grounds.
Well, I'm sure it was like also payback because he had been an organizer of, I mean, they were like, you're the reason why everybody
got elected, huh?
Exactly.
So David, Molly, Max, Jim, Betty, and Jeanine.
So what are we doing?
Yes. Challenges and successes, in SCLC scope. Groups will discuss grassroots challenges and successes in the project and campaigns. Well, ours is not a lot different than, ours is somewhat different than what Lanny was saying, but we ran up against the same thing exactly with one day a month, the polls were opened, and then there was a deliberate tactical slowdown to register people. And I don't remember the numbers, but there were a lot of people in line for our first registration day, first day that they were open. We had a lot of people, maybe 100, that was a lot for us. And maybe 20 or 30 got registered, and they refused to register.
And that was what county?
Allendale, South Carolina.
I guess we have to say her name.
Oh, right, Jeanine. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
Jeanine.
Thank you. I'm Molly Murdy. What I remember in terms of some of the challenges of registering people was going with a group of people to the courthouse, and then the registrar would just close her office.
Oh. Hmm. Which county was this?
This was America, Sumter County, Georgia.
Oh.
And the registrar was a woman. But she was connected to a family, the Chappelle family, that seemed to be everywhere. Her brother was the county sheriff. Mm-hmm. He was infamous. And then she was his sister. She was the registrar. And then another brother was in the Georgia State Patrol. There was another relative that was on the town council. And another sibling that, what was his position? I can't remember, but anyway, they were everywhere, as you can imagine. And so she would simply just close, office closed for the day, down would come this window. And there were times when we still wouldn't leave, And then they just closed the entire courthouse, not just the registrar's office. So now once the Voting Rights Bill passed, that situation stopped. And amazingly, everyone was shocked. They hired two African-American women as part-time registrars to handle the influx of people. And it was not the kind of community that you would expect to do that. You know, when 2 weeks earlier they were closing the office every time people came in to register. So, I mean, it was very, you know, certainly very positive, but it was unexpected. No one saw it coming that they were going to do something like
yes.
that.
So you didn't end up doing any organizing of opposition to that, any civil disobedience or anything?
Oh, yes, there were lots of marches and rallies at the courthouse.
But you didn't, like, sit in or anything?
Yeah, there were times, there was at least one occasion where we stayed all night in the parking lot.
And they didn't, oh, in the parking lot. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Max Rice. Something very similar happened in Lawrence County, Dublin, Georgia. And we would go in with two or three people, and we didn't take too many at a time. And well, as soon as they saw a black person in that window, clunk, just a little door would come down. And you'd knock on the door, and it was locked, and you know, there's no response. Yeah, I did that quite a few times. And frankly, I don't remember what happened. The Voting Rights Act was passed on August 6th.
Yeah.
And so I was there at least another month, and I frankly don't remember if we ever. But we did actually, at the end of the month, I know that end of the summer, we had registered approximately, I think it was around 300 people. So, but again, I heard that that might be a fictitious number, according to Joel Friedman. I don't know.
Molly Murdy, again, in terms of numbers, I was relating to what you just said. My understanding, and I think this is probably accurate, from mid-June until the time the Voting Rights Act passed, we managed to register only 49 people. And then, you know, once the Voting Rights Act passed and they hired those two other registrars, I don't really know the numbers then, but you could tell it was a pretty massive increase. But prior to that, I wouldn't say we were very successful in registering people. Mm.
This is David. As far as successes go, according to an article in the Southern Courier newspaper, 65 people registered during the summer, which frankly is not very many. Three restaurants were integrated, and as Bruce has said, the parents of the kids who participated in the sit-ins were extremely proud of what their kids did. I'd like to report a success, or I consider it a success on a personal level, is that when we went around talking to people, they would call us Mr. and Sir because they were just used to talking to white people that way. Yep. And just sort of little by little, over maybe 15 or 20 minutes, they decided it was safe to call us David and Bruce and so on. And I felt that was a huge victory, that here we were teaching them that there are white people who will just treat them totally as equals.
That was something, this is Betty, and that was something I mentioned yesterday in a session, you know, there was some issue about the role of scope workers and the impact that they had that someone thought ignored the ongoing issues, the leadership formation in the community prior to scope's arrival, and then what had to be done afterwards. And I said that and I was 12 years old in Crawfordville, which is about 100 miles from here. Mm-hmm. My parents had been fired, and that was a part of the struggle. You know, they let me be involved. My grandmother and I went out in the county recruiting people, encouraging people to register. And of course, she did most of the work swinging out of the car. She knew a lot of people, had relatives too. And so we went around doing that more than going to the courthouse. But one thing I said about the situation was that the scope organizers were the first white friends that people in these areas ever had. And that was important in such a hostile, racially charged environment. And I think it helped more in the adaptation to having a more multiracial society. In Crawfordville now, I don't know how much people socialize in each other's house, but they are their friends who talk about personal things with each other across racial lines. And I think that helped, you know, the experience of having scope volunteers in the community.
Yeah, listen back again. Thing that struck me was early on, and we worked mostly with high school students. The NAACP Youth Council in Dublin was very active. A guy named Reuben Gamble, who just, I understand, just died 3 or 4 years ago. He was the spark plug in the powerhouse for those kids. And they would call me Mr. Vice. And finally they got the kids, I think, were a little bolder than the adults, you know. And they would want to, they'd come up and we'd talk, and they'd say, "Can I touch you? I'll touch your arm." As like Delaney said, "I want to touch your hair."
Mm-hmm. Such fine hair.
Yes. and again, it was the first time that when I had a small car, I had a little Renault, I drove around, and whenever I was taking somebody somewhere, they wanted to get the back seat. I got the front seat here. So it not only was, I think, transformative for them to have that a little bit more intimate relationship with a white person, but frankly, for me too. I mean, I came from a farm in Michigan, you know, and I hadn't spent a lot of time, I mean, day after day with black people, so it was transformative for me too.
Huh. Are you from Michigan?
Yeah.
What part?
East of Flint, Lapeer County.
Ah. Are you still there?
No. Oh. My family farm is there, but it's gone now.
So what are the topics we're on right now?
It's just basically challenges and successes in SCLC and scope.
I was a little confused because that's what it says here, but the person who spoke just before we broke into groups said we were supposed to talk about what happened when we came home in our own communities and our impact on our families and our communities, which isn't what it says
right.
Here, so this I don't
is,
know.
All right, so I'm Bruce. That's a very interesting topic, but why don't we first do the successes?
Well, sure, I'm not sure what topic we do. I just wondered which one was accurate.
And you didn't get a chance to talk about
it. Well,
and you are?
Jim Keck. And my story is I was not with Scope. I was working in Chicago with SCLC. And my only venture into the South was the Meredith March, the last day, the rally in Jackson, okay, came down.
Boy, was that hot.
Oh, my God, yes. Anyway, but I mean, the thing I can relate to, I mean, based on what you guys said, is that I was in Chicago, and my first experience in the black community was like in high school, and I was in Cabrini-Green area.
Oh.
And do you know this is Chicago, supposedly, it's supposed to be this enlightened city and all this kind of stuff? The African-American kids treated me the same way. They wanted to touch my hair. I mean, can you believe in a city like Chicago, there were black kids that had no contact with white people, that it was so segregated there too, you know, and that kids would just want to touch you because they didn't know what a white person felt like. Isn't that weird? Horrible. It's just horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm Jean Billingsley. I did not work with Scope, but I was born and lived the first 9 years of my life in Albany, Georgia. And so I think in hearing conversations, a couple of, I guess, just perspectives that I have, and especially when you talk about the kinds of relationships that were built with Scope and how those relationships were relationships of equality. I grew up hearing a lot about black and white relationships in Southwest Georgia. My grandmother was the cook at a white boarding house, and my mother and my sister, my mother and her sister and her siblings worked as children in that boarding house. And so they had very close, intimate relationships with their employers, but they were not on a basis of equality. The interesting thing that my mother remembers is that when she and her sister were in high school, the owner of the boarding house, an Irish woman who was barely literate, got my mother and her sister to begin to get and respond to the mail because she had not been able to do it. So when you all talk about people, you know, seeing and sort of being with whites for the first time, that may have very well been the case, and it's interesting for me to think about that in rural Southwest Georgia. But in the urban centers, there were these relationships, but they were what Angela Davis called them, relationships of deformed intimacy.
Right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, they, you know, my father played with white boys until they became police officers. Okay, and then it was a very different, you know, kind of relationship. And that's one of the reasons he left Georgia. So that, and I think the other thing that I've heard that I'm really, really interested in is how Scope helped to develop community leadership, that once Scope workers left, there were people in the community who took on some leadership responsibilities. And I think that's really good, and I wanna find out more about it, because SCLC's field staff historically has been accused of destroying local leadership, and especially with some of the big local, some of the big movements, you know, in Albany. That was a big problem with the Albany movement. There was a local leadership structure there. And when Dr. Abernathy and Dr. King came in, you know, much of the work that SNCC had done with that local leadership was just mediated. I mean, it was...
Being in America's, I've heard a lot about what you're talking about in Albany. There were already SNCC people in Americas that had been there quite some time,
right,
and they were afraid of something like that occurring
again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very, very aware of that.
Of that, yes.
And you are?
I'm Molly.
Okay.
This is
and
Ben.
You were in Americas.
I was in Americas,
okay.
Yes.
So was Ben Clark there when you were there?
Well, at the beginning, there was just me and two other Scope volunteers.
Okay.
And then the SNCC people who are already there,
okay,
who have been there since 63.
Okay.
But then one of the, in our group of three Scope people, mm-hmm, one of the people left after about a month. So then there were just two of us. Mm-hmm. And that all worked out fine. But then at a certain point, toward the very end of July, mm-hmm, a large team of Scope people came, including Ben Clark and
okay,
Roy Bolden. And Hosea was there at least once, maybe twice.
Okay.
And then a lot of Scope volunteers were pulled out of other communities like Macon,
mm-hmm,
and Albany,
oh, okay,
and Savannah,
okay,
and sent there. They sent all together at least 38 extra people who all came at once and more or less took over organizing some of the marches and rallies we were having about these four local women who were illegally being held in jail. And yes, there was resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually sided with SNCC and the local leadership because it was like,
mm-hmm,
all of a sudden these other people were rearranging,
mm-hmm,
everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was a good thing. I mean, it might have had very good intentions,
mm-hmm,
but it, to me it seemed rather overpowering and somewhat arrogant.
Oh yeah, I'm trying to tease that out. You know,
mm-hmm. Okay. This is Bruce. One of the things we want to keep in mind in these group discussions is to let everybody talk and go around once before, you know, so that everyone.
Before discussion.
Well, I'm just reminding. and this is a really interesting topic, but
mm-hmm,
I wanted to speak go back to what you were talking about, and you were talking about being the first white people and black-white relations. And I was thinking, other than people like us, I mean, most of America has no idea of the insanity and hysteria of segregation. As you know, before I was with SCLC, I worked with CORE, and there was a big CORE project in Bogalusa, Louisiana, which was an industrial city. And because the industry there had national government contracts, they had to have an integrated workforce, meaning that the blacks were in the low-paid, dangerous, and worse jobs, and the whites in the other jobs. But there was a case where a white worker and a black worker had a mutual love of the blues. And the black worker invited the white worker over to his home to play blues on the guitar. And the black worker was fired and arrested and driven out of the county. And when we first came to Selma, well, SNCC had been there from 63, but when SCLC, when I got to Selma, one of the jobs they told me to do was that I would call, cold call, on the telephone, people who had phones and talk, you know, tell them about the mass meeting. I said, well, what if I get a white person? And they said, oh, don't worry about that, Bruce. Look at the phone book. And the Selma phone book was very nicely printed. There would be Mr. and Mrs. Bob Allen. There would be Joe Allen. All the whites were Mr., Miss, or Mrs. All the blacks were first name, last name.
So it was easy.
It was totally easy for us to organize, you know. And the craziness and the vision. One of the things I did not realize is that so much of this segregation was, well, it was all designed to keep black people subservient, but it was also designed to make sure that no white people got out of line, you know, by having any kind of friendship with or alliance with. There's a story that only recently has become famous, but it's a true story. And that is when the Freedom Rider bus was bombed and set afire outside of Anniston by the mob that chased them out. And the Freedom Riders, if it hadn't been for an undercover cop on the bus who pulled his gun to get the door open, they were holding the door closed while the bus burned to burn them. They opened it, they tumbled out, they were all choking from smoke, and they were, you know, had smoke inhalation. So they were right in front of this little store, country store run by white folks. And this 12-year-old white girl said, oh, here's some people choking from smoke, and she brought them a glass of water. That whole family was driven out of Gadsden County, and they could never return under threat of death. And that this segregation thing was crazy. So when you talk about the, you know, what it meant to have the first black-white friendships, that had enormous political implications. That was really cracking something that had been enforced with violence and law for generations. So I think that's really very important.
Well, the same thing, Janine, the same thing happened with being in people's houses, because when we, apparently, I just heard this story a couple days ago when we stopped to see the son of the minister that invited us to come into Allendale County. And he told us, he said, did you know this story of when you were coming, that there were a lot of people in the town in Allendale that wanted to have you at their house and wanted to be the host? And then it got to be a couple of days before, and everybody backed out. They got really scared because white people didn't even go into black people's houses, let alone stay there as a guest, and so they didn't know what they were going to do, and so the minister sent his son, who was the person we were meeting with, over to the house behind him and said, well, we have some guests coming in town. Would you please let them stay there overnight? And she said, sure. And so we arrived, and another woman and I were sent, no, actually my brother and I were sent over to her house, and we knocked on the door, and she came to the door, and she almost fell down because she didn't know that the guests were going to be white. And we said, oh, we're here. And she said, oh, well, come in. And we didn't understand the hesitancy. Now I understand. Mm-hmm. Because nobody else was taking us in. And then, so she kindly let us stay there. And then a few days later, when that house didn't burn down, and the house that the others were staying in, which was the minister's house, they just crowded there, I guess, didn't burn down. Then all of a sudden, people in town said, oh, we'll have one. We want one. So then we all got to be spread out. But Robbie said, do you know that nobody ever had a white person in their house?
Your turn.
Oh.
So do you know what we're talking about? We were talking about the successes and challenges of the SEL Scope project, and then we're going to move on to, so what did we do when we got back home? How did that influence the rest of our lives?
Oh, okay. I'm late, and I just walked into the room that I was in yesterday. Michelle Hutchinson, is that thing picking up the whole thing?
It should.
Because yesterday we were passing
it should pick
around,
up the whole room.
Okay.
One hopes.
It's quiet. So.
Yeah. Speaker, anyway.
I was kind of set off yesterday evening when, I'm not sure who on the stage announced it, that we thank you all, you know, white people, for going into Scope, because there were as many black people in Scope that would have filled up that room.
Really?
Yes. We were a whole group of white, black people from black colleges and universities. And I actually never saw a white person until the end, when we were sitting in this black-owned funeral home and they announced the Civil Rights Bill had passed. And then there were a lot of white kids sitting on the floor, you know, and we were all standing around, and that's the first time I saw white people. So I was really shocked when that person announced that yesterday. Thanks for all your courage, which I still thank you for all your courage. I just didn't know that there was that many white people in Scope. We never saw them.
So there. Okay. So you came from a northern college also?
No, I came from a southern college. HBCU. Philadelphia is my home, fourth generation, but I went to college at an HBCU in Charlotte, North Carolina, Johnson C. Smith University. Mm-hmm. And either Golden Franks or Hosea knew the minister on our campus. The only reason we were at university is because they had a seminary, okay? So Reverend Worsley, he went around and handpicked us based on our personalities, okay? I don't know why he handpicked me, because I was quiet. I mean, I was in leadership. I was in leadership. I was also an activist in the community, but I was a quiet person, okay? I didn't get loud until I got in the army and curse and stuff like that, so I know what was going on. But anyway, he picked about eight of us, and we went down to Morris Brown to be trained. And I asked a guy sitting next to me last night, I said, did you go to Morris Brown? And he said, yeah. Well, we went to Morris Brown. The Reverend, he told us we weren't hitting each other hard enough. We need to knock each other down. We were getting ready to go into a situation where we'd be beat up, put in jail, and, you know, and we were. We were beat up, hospitalized, and put in jail.
So you had the orientation in Atlanta?
Yeah, at Morris Brown. And, you know, he hit me good in the back, you know, till I went down.
Were they two separate orientations, or?
I never saw any white people there. There was Bayard Rustin, there was James and Diane Bevel, there was Golden Franks, there was Jose Williams, and there were black students, black people from all over.
Do you remember the date, what month and day?
No, I just know it started with when we left for the summer. That's all I know.
Because it was full of 300, the one where I went to, 300 students, and they were all white.
And you are.
Yeah, and ours were
Janine.
All black. And how many
well, they
were
all
there?
White.
Oh, we could have filled that room bigger than you did yesterday.
Well, there must have been two grand
projects.
Well, there were a lot.
I didn't keep up after we had such great times, and they kept us together. Okay, like the Johnson C. Smith students. Okay, I was the coordinator, you know, in charge of everything and setting up. And we lived with the black people where we worked. And we worked in several places, okay? We started out with three places in North Carolina. Then we went to Montgomery, where we got shot at and we didn't hit the floor, even though the people that the black people at home didn't know hit the floor, but we had been trained hit the floor with any little sound, you know. And then we went to Birmingham, we went to Mississippi where we stayed with Hattie Lou Famer and some of her friends. And then we went to Selma. And so we had to get out in the fields wherever we went and work with the people. And we were all rural. We were never in, even though those places were small, they still had little, you know, the courthouse and stuff and a few little restaurants and businesses around. But everybody we stayed with was rural in the fields. So we got in the fields and stuff. And that was horrible. It was good that God never made me a slave. I'd have been a double amputee foot like Kunta Kinte. But our task was to teach them how to first write their names, just the letter, not the whole alphabet, and how to write yes or no, and then how to make some kind of a signature. At least start off with the M, and then you could go across, or the K, and then you could scribble it across. And we also taught them, because there were no black people running for office in these places, we also taught them that you make a list of your priorities in terms of your family and your community, and then you look at the slate of the person who's running for office and see which one hit some of your priorities, and that's the person that you would vote for. I do that still today. I don't say vote Democrat, don't vote, you know. We still do that today. And so when we left, we knew that we had an organization, at least in the rural area of the county we left. Okay, and I kept up with some of the people that I stayed in the homes with, but I never kept up with the SCOPE people. Only those that came back to Johnson C. Smith and then graduated, and then we never kept up with each other after that. But when Sherry Lebedis called me, I did call the director of alumni and gave her the names of some of the people that were with me that I can remember. She called me back and she told me, they said they weren't interested. I said, I couldn't be interested. Well, you know, they had become doctors and lawyers and CPAs. I guess they thought it was above them, you know. But I thought that it was a great thing. And she had written, Sherrod, my name, it was at my old address, the mail came to my other address, but she wrote in the corner, S-C-O-P-E. I tore that letter open, you know, and I was so glad. It was so close to the time that this was going to happen. I didn't have much maneuvering time. But the counties where we left, if that's where the interest is, those people organized. They organized and they became better. And there were two homes lost. There were many jobs lost. Okay, the women were never fired from their job because they did the white people's wash and ironing at their own home and then took it back to the white people. They didn't do it at the white people's home. But their husbands lost jobs, okay? But that was something that they were willing to do because, see, all this was set up by SCLC before we came into the communities. They knew that they had the threat of losing their jobs. Okay? So we considered it a success because they knew they were going to lose their jobs. So we considered what we did was a success. We didn't know why we were, well, we kind of did. Jose was always saying, okay, y'all got this county under control, we're going to move you over here. And then he come back. I don't know how he saw all y'all, because he saw us practically every day where we went. Him, either him or Golden Frings, you know. And then when they started the, what was it, Poor People's March? Yeah.
In 68, 67.
Yeah, right, uh-huh. Then they contacted me and asked me, you know, could I organize? But I was in graduate school at the time, and I was in University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I didn't know a soul. I didn't know how to reach anybody, so I didn't know about you guys. I didn't know about you guys until I came in here. You know, I walked over to each table and said, Scope people? Scope people, and I came to their desk and said, well, gosh, their hair is white. It's whiter than, my hair won't ever get white. My sisters and my aunts is pure white, but the rest of us have this hair like my mother had, you know, barely gray. But I walked over to them, and then she said, yes. And I said, oh, okay. I'm going to the wrong tables, the black tables. So, you know, that's my tale, and I gladly tell it. My children and my grandchildren know about Scope, okay? And my oldest grandchild is 22, and he has picked up, you know, the mantle, and he places the posters for voting in the shops like I used to do, and he also comes and helps me register. We registered 400 people for the voter last year. The voter registration came out to where the seniors live, Metropolitan Housing, and they did the photo voter there, so we still at it.
Thank you, Chuck. Yeah, thank you. What time does this end? What time are we supposed to end?
3:30.
What time is it?
It's about 5 minutes.
Okay.
I don't want to talk a lot again, but this is just very peculiar. That sounds like they were parallel oriented. Janine, parallel orientations. I don't think that
happened. This is Max. Because I remember black people being in the same group with us.
But she doesn't remember any white people.
So it had to be at a different time.
There were a lot of
did you all have that the same day? Were you all on the same day?
Five days.
We were there for a week.
Yeah, a week.
Yeah.
It was June 14th that it started. And
June 12th,
then it was,
I think.
I think it was the 12th.
You know, I would just venture. I'm Jean Billington. I would just venture to guess that recruitment at HBCUs may have been different.
Yeah.
And it may have been at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, just from looking back at old documents and talking to people like Gene T, and Bill Treanor, and Al Sampson, I just have the sense that there were very specifically major white and some small liberal arts institutions. Were targeted because it was felt that bringing white students south was going to bring more attention. And then I know from having worked at an HBCU for over 20 years and having had family members who were in HBCUs during the height of the civil rights movement, it was very, very complicated to get black students involved. So it could be that there was just a very different...
Even in Charlotte at the time, my cousin, he had led the integration integration as far as it would go in Charlotte. But when we came there to school, the blacks had to sit up in the balcony for the movie and the whites downstairs. I was upset, okay? But I said, well, okay, we need to still do some work here, and we continue to do that, you know.
I have a quick question. This is Max. You were in Albany.
Yes, I lived in Albany until I was 9 years old. I grew up in New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Well, my question is, I haven't heard, I'm the only one, I think, that I've heard mention the Southwest Georgia Project, which was centered around Albany.
Oh, yeah.
And so you weren't there during the 65, 66?
I had cousins who were there.
Okay, because I worked there from 67, 68. I was there for a year. With
67
Charles,
to 68?
Yeah.
In Albany?
Charles Sherrod.
Sherrod, okay.
Shirley.
Okay.
And
what was the project in 67 and 68?
Oh gosh, it was basically a community organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we moved all over that region.
Yeah.
I was even stuck down in Beechton, which is right on the border of Florida, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But we moved around quite a lot during that year. Yeah. But I haven't heard anybody talk about Southwest Georgia Project. Not, I understand this is a scope project, you're
right, right.
But I have heard, you know, people talk about core and so on.
I don't know.
Well, I've mentioned it to people because I was aware of it being Sumter County, because the Southwest Georgia Project at one time was also in Lee County and Terrell County, which were just
Bad Baker.
This is Bruce. So just add one thing that. In addition to the scope volunteers, from the outside of the scope volunteers, at least in my county, and I'm pretty sure in a bunch of other counties, some of the local students, either the high school students or college students who come back from the summer, were given a stipend by SCLC to work with the scope project. So we had a couple, you remember who I'm talking about, the Ware girl and another guy.
So this was after the summer of 65?
No, this was during the summer of 65. Families got, in theory, a stipend to feed us. And then some of the students, one or two of the students, would be paid a stipend because the black students had to earn some money over the summer in order to go back to college, so they couldn't just volunteer. So they were given some money, and they were some of the ones who accompanied us, and they were essentially scope volunteer. They were scope workers, but they were paid a stipend. And the other thing that was going on is that, which is hardly ever talked about, fortunately, someone in the session talked about is the citizenship education.
And that's what I was just about to say, because I've run across documents, and now Ponder kept CDP programs in Albany, and a couple of the other workers. But this was mostly the CEP programs. I think were mostly 63, 62, 63. I don't know. Really, 65?
It started. Well, it started on Johns Island, South Carolina.
No. CEP in Albany.
Oh, in Albany.
In Albany.
Oh,
so
I
that's,
know.
Yeah, yeah. Because I know Ponder.
Yeah.
Did a CEP program in Albany, and there were a couple of other. Workers with her. At that point, it would have been difficult for me to identify who worked with SNCC and who worked with SCLC.
CEP was all over the South.
It was all over the South. But from, I think what I know about the Albany movement, and my memory's just like everybody else's, highly unreliable. But by 1965, Albany had really sort of morphed into a really difficult space. You know, the height of the movement, of course, it started at the end of 61, all through 62. But my reading is the Justice Department did a lot to stifle that movement. You know, they sent in people, and And they worked, you know, people who were with the Albany movement just saw them with Pritchard and white policemen.
Mm.
Okay, FBI agents came into Albany, but they were with Pritchard and white policemen.
Mm.
And, you know, the way in which the media is shrewdly, shrewdly portraying Pritchard as a nonviolent, peaceful man was just an incredible construction. And my sense is they had to have help to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Because my mother was a schoolmate of C.B. King, and we very much, my family knew that whole King family. And Slater King has written about how violent Pritchard was. He broke his arm. Pritchard beat his wife while she was pregnant, and she lost a baby. So, but by 65, Albany was just in a mess in terms of the movement. And I think it was because it was a kind of battleground for what happened with SNCC and SCLC. Dr. Anderson, I'm told, that a couple of reports have really started to have some difficulty himself as a leader. And I think the thing that comes out of Albany for me, and that has to do with my research, it was after Albany that SCLC has an executive memo from, I mean a memo or minutes from executive staff meeting. After Albany, SCLC knew they needed field staff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they saw how effective SNCC had been.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, SCLC had nothing comparable. Mm-hmm. And so it was after Albany that they knew they needed to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps some of the other people who haven't had spoken so much should chime in.
Well, one thing that intrigues me about often these discussions over the years is that there's always two sides to every story. There's always a, you know, and one of the things is that what I have trouble with is like Dr. King was abused a lot by local groups. I mean, they wanted his name, they wanted his publicity wherever he went, right? The media followed, and then to complain later, you know, that their local stuff was taken away from them.
Yeah.
It was like, I know, I'm coming, because I wasn't in the South, but in Chicago, I swear to God, our local groups ate him alive. It wasn't the Mayor Daley that destroyed him, it was the local groups who basically invited him in and then wouldn't listen to him. I mean, it was like, you know, they would like use him publicity-wise, but when it came down to it, they were all they had done just what they did before they invited him. They all fought with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, so we have Jesse Jackson, we have, you know, which you've heard enough about Chicago, you know, and it was like, how, you know, Mayor, Dr. King like walked out with his tail between his legs. It was like, he got sold down the river.
Really?
And a lot of these places, I mean, it was like, well, you invited him, you know, like, you wanted his name recognition, you wanted all this, you were, and like SNCC, they were getting somewhere, but they weren't getting
that far.
That's
so true.
And then the other thing is, look at how even Martin Luther King evolved.
Yeah.
There's the NAACP working for years in Montgomery, right? Getting almost nowhere.
Right.
And then they get him. None of the ministers would support them.
Right.
And they get this young new minister to town who comes from a prominent family in Atlanta and has got a lot of independence about him, right? But the locals, they weren't going to get involved with the NAACP. They all shied away. They had all been bought off, just like Chicago bought off all the
Black
Baptist ministers, you know. So, I mean, it's kind of, you know, part of the story is, I mean.
I think part of the story is that everybody thought that there was integration and everything was going fine up north.
And
that only happened in the South.
Right.
But he and his posse knew that, you know, the northern states were just as bad. It just didn't look the same, you know. And so when he comes, you know, the black folk either didn't even know about him or didn't want him because they knew about him, you know.
Well, the established black leadership of Chicago did not want him in town.
No, same thing, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Everybody says, oh, Philadelphia was the first place that welcomed slaves. Huh? Philadelphia was as segregated as possible. And then by the time I got really to go to start to school, things started to open up because I was sent out of my neighborhood for elementary school and for junior high. I had begged my parents, to let me go to a neighborhood high school. And when I got to the neighborhood high school, it was predominantly Jewish and a few black people and very few white people. But the white people had black accents. Okay, so you knew in some way, shape, or form, they either lived in a poor black community or so and so and so and so. And everybody got along fine except for the teachers. You know, the teachers didn't want us to be together. And the Jewish kids could care less. In fact, one big problem we had is that they were all white cheerleaders. And every time a black girl would go out for cheerleading and be the best, she never got it. Well, I don't know if you remember Tammy Terrell. She sang with Marvin Gaye, okay? Well, her name was Thomasina Montgomery in school. And she was light-skinned. So everybody said, well, her legs are the same color as everybody else. So what do you teachers have to complain about now? And so she was the first black cheerleader in Germantown High School.
Yeah.
You know? Because the teacher said, no, the black legs will look different from the white legs and stuff like that. But Tammy Terrell was light-skinned, black, and a lot of the Jewish girls were really darker than white, you know, because Jewish people at that time were dark, and they had hooked noses and stuff, you see. So that went on. That was a big thing, you know. And but we heard on the news all the time about what was happening in the South. You know, but King and like I say, his posse knew that there were problems in northern cities, and they wanted to bring that out. You know,
definitely.
Crawfordville in Tolliver County was one of the smallest counties in Georgia. I think it was 154th out of 159 at that time.
Wow.
It may be 158 or 159 from what people are saying. One thing that happened in the rural communities of the South is that with consolidation and lack of jobs, people moved into towns. Or probably half of Crawfordville is in Atlanta right now.
Oh,
uh-huh. And so when you talk about the leadership was in place there before SCLC came in. But we boycotted the stores. And I'm not, you know, criticizing that. But the businesses never really reestablished themselves.
In Crawford.
Yes, uh-huh. And so the white businesses that were involved eventually closed, I would say within a few years of the movement. There was an enterprise started, a raincoat factory started by SCLC there, which probably helped with unemployment, but you know, I haven't done enough research to see.
Do you know what year?
It was probably, my father worked there. Part of that. He's all interwoven with the history of that. But I think it was probably in 1969 or 70.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And it lasted for maybe 10 years.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So that population decrease in rural counties was a factor undermining leadership. You're just not going to have a continuity. Frank Bates was the youth leader there, and he went to college at Fort Valley and then to law school and settled in, you know, I think he might have come back to Crawfordville for a while, but settled in Atlanta and still lives here.
Right.
My father was the principal of the school. My parents were there. They both lost their jobs. My father couldn't get another principalship, so he had a master's. He went and got his doctorate and, you know, went to Tuskegee to teach. And my mother got another teaching job, went back to an old teaching job at the state hospital in Millersville.
Okay.
And then, so we weren't around when the busing situation arose. We went with her. So I'm saying there are economic dynamics.
Oh, yes.
The urbanization and everything that are large factors, macro factors that are, you know, undermining this whole process.
You're right.
And I appreciate, I'm Jean Billings again, what you said about Chicago, not only because I'm interested in Chicago, but because of the complexity and how the history sort of gets truncated and simplified, and that relationship between SCLC and SNCC is one that's going in that direction.
Oh,
I can
yeah.
see from the historiography. But not only, you know, was Ella Baker instrumental mm-hmm. in that founding of SNCC up in Raleigh, mm-hmm. But probably, because I had a chance to look at some old SNCC archives, probably for at least a year or more, SNCC actually had offices at SCLC, 33 and a half.
Yeah, yeah. That's under Julian Barnwell.
And you know, they had a little budget, you know, that SCLC was helping. And I think the reason I'm interested in that, because my experience at SCLC, and this was late, by the time I got there in 1967, what they really, and Jose, I think, was past master at it, they understood mentoring youth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They really understood
yeah.
it, and they understood the value of it, and they
yes.
knew how to do it.
Exactly.
You know, they knew mm-hmm. how to do it.
Yes.
So somehow, you know, I've started to read these really, really interesting histories of SNCC, and, you know, good scholarship coming out, but it's a little bit more complicated, I think, than what I'm reading.
Oh, yeah.
Maxine, you and Dave haven't had a chance to talk very much.
You're
talking. Okay, Dave.
Well, gee, I'm sort of trying to tack on to what others have said, but experience has been pretty much different. Let's see, can we
sure.
go?
I want to make sure everybody gets a chance,
yeah.
that's all.
But the other topic was how did we readjust after we came back home? So now I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
And because the atmosphere there was just totally different from Crenshaw County, because Crenshaw County was like a total population of 10,000 roughly.
It's that.
And Silver Spring is a big suburb. So going back, it felt really that I was back home, and I decompressed quite a bit. Because in Crenshaw County, I had what I would call a healthy paranoia. That is, watching out for gangs of white people. and I remember that driving back to Silver Spring, when I was just short of Washington, D.C., that was in Virginia, Northern Virginia, I got passed by a car with Alabama license plates, and my first reaction was, they're after me. and then I thought for a minute, hold on, if they were going to do anything, they would have done it 700 miles back. They wouldn't chase me all the way here. So it was really just relaxing and decompressing.
Wow.
Well, this is Max. I do recall an incident. The fact that I hadn't thought about it for 50 years, and this whole thing has jogged my memory. And my naivete there when I first went to Lawrence County is astounding. I mean, I had this little Renault, a little red car, and anybody could see the red car. And I don't remember the circumstances, but for some reason I drove with a black girl, high school student, to the local Dairy Queen. And she stayed in the car, I went in, I got a couple of cones and came back out, and immediately this white guy came over with a knife, and he looked through the window and he put that right at my throat, and he said, "You're a pretty son of a bitch." And I said, "Thank you." I rolled the window and put it in reverse. But you know, I think back now that you know how close you come sometimes. You know,
yeah.
Yeah.
You came home to that.
I did. Well, I mean, it was only a month later, and I got everything beat out of me. I did. In the
what
hospital.
Made you think that she could get in your car and ride with you?
Well, you know. I don't know, but I still think that the young people, the high school students,
mm-hmm.
were not necessarily naive. Well, maybe they were, but they were more willing to take risks.
Yes, even so.
She must have understood there was a risk there. I mean, she grew up in that town. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really comprehend it at the time. And I had been told that at the orientation meeting, and I'll do that. I should have done that. I was young, too. So.
Well, I think of Janine. The orientation, it felt like, oh, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do. But then you get there and there's people that you know and people that are, well, how could you tell somebody, no, we can't do that because we're different colors. It just didn't sort of fit with what our whole intent was. Mm-hmm. And our counties want to say something about that there wasn't a lot of leadership already in our county when we got there. The minister that called us in wasn't really in a position of leadership. He wanted to sort of be in that, but there was actually somebody else, and I still haven't teased this out. There's somebody else, a name on there, but apparently he was frightened, another minister, and he never came forward. We didn't even sort of know who he was, but on paper he was the person that was supposed to be taking the leadership and helping direct us what to do. And so a lot of young people joined in with us, and... actually now, I don't know if you saw, but at one point, Joe Freeman sent out a note earlier on in the summer saying that, oh, in Allendale County, they just received this recognition by the state as a legal document that says we recognize these five people in Allendale, South Carolina for their work in scope back in 65. Wow. Two of them had died already. Three of them are still there. And they were the people that, as young people, joined us, and we together worked as a team. And now, finally, 50 years later, they're being recognized. One of them that I was going to go visit tomorrow, but the weather isn't going to prevent it to happen. We were going to go.
Allendale, South Carolina?
Yes.
That is, have you been back there?
No.
That's, you've heard of the 95 Carter. You've seen the movie of the 95 Carter?
No.
It comes on PBS. Mm-hmm. Allendale County, there was money set aside to improve Allendale County. And not one governor of South Carolina has put that money there. Mm-hmm. And now where there used to be poor blacks, there are more poor Mexicans and Hispanic than there are poor blacks. And the schools are all broken. The water is coming in. They won't.
That's
you
just
would
what
never
I,
believe that there's been no change.
That's what I just heard from the person that used to live there,
who
now is in Washington, D.C. And he said the county has just gone downhill. One of the women that we worked with that I was going to go see is the chair of the Democratic Party for Allendale County now. She's Marion Jennings. And we're going to go see her, but she said you wouldn't recognize the place. It's just gone down.
Worse. Oh,
people, and Robbie, the other person, said the young people, it's drugs. And
oh,
it's
so
a mess.
Rotten.
It's really sad. But most people, if they could, they got out. And so the population of that community is
all
way down.
All poverty.
Down.
What part of
the schools?
South, just an hour north of Savannah.
It's called the film is called the 95 Corridor.
Okay. The 95, what's that word?
Corridor.
Oh, the 95 Corridor. Oh, okay.
I think, and the person that did the film, she works at SETV, South Carolina ETV.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, South Carolina ETV and Boston ETV are two of the best in the nation.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. We have a great ETV, radio and TV, but TV, Boston are both some of the best in the nation. And we switch a lot of stuff. But that 95 Carter, she worked there, and she took as her project to show how Allendale, there are many corporations in Columbia, Colonial Insurance is one, that they take up money every year, they buy books every year, and they take them down there to Allendale County.
Mm-hmm.
You
wow.
see, yeah.
Wow.
You're going there?
Well, we were, but you know, there's
oh, the weather is
the weather is not going to let us do that.
And
we're so sad because we don't see
Monday. Oh, yeah, and it's supposed to be through Monday.
Through Monday.
Yeah, and already Columbia, where it always floods, it's already...
Well, already they're saying in Augusta, don't go in Augusta.
Yeah, really? Charleston has 2 feet.
Really?
Yeah.
What? So there's so much
water.
Yeah,
Charleston has 2 feet.
Worse than ever. Yeah. Flash floods, it's a mess.
And the hurricane, out to sea.
But it's not the hurricane.
But it's the waves that have come in and the rain. It has come with
well, there's another front, a polar front of some sort that's come way, way, way down and dipped back up and coming right up the corridor.
Oh,
there.
Okay.
So this is separate from
oh, yeah,
the hurricane.
It is. And and also, you know, Charleston's below sea level.
Yes.
So their streets, when I left my room, were 2 feet tall. I mean, you could see the rain, the cars, mm-hmm. and everything. And Columbia... They did a special on Columbia because there's, you know, there's one river. We have 3 rivers, and the one river divides. And where that river divides, all those places are flooded. And it will rain throughout Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's about 3:30, and then we're required to
That's amazing.
Yes.